Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. This week we are celebrating International Women's Day, a day that originated with strikes of working women, particularly garment factory workers. We will pay tribute to those striking women by exploring a sweatshop issue in our own backyard of Iowa. Though garment factory conditions today continue to be horrendous, 13 years ago, students at the University of Iowa decided that they did have power to change the conditions under which certain clothing was manufactured. I'm your host, Greta Anderson, and after exploring the history of Women's Day, I interview two activists from the University of Iowa's Students Against Sweatshops, and then ask ISU's Senior Vice President of Business and Finance, Warren Madden, what, if anything, has been done here. International Women's Day grew out of a socialist gathering of women held in late winter of 1909 in New York. The following winter, New York was the site of a three-month strike in which 20,000 garment factory workers protested conditions at Triangle Shirtwaist and other sweatshops. 1 year later, in March 1911, 146 women and girls perished in the horrific Triangle Shirtwaist fire, many of them jumping to their death from upper-story windows. The next year, in 1912, factory workers in Lawrence, Massachusetts, made their mark by striking for 2 months in the dead of winter. Here is Utah Phillips' description of that strike and the song that came out of it.
Up in Lawrence, the laborers that worked there were contract laborers brought over from France and the Low Countries, not good enough to be citizens. Good enough to work their whole lives out, spitting up blood at the looms. Not good enough to vote for all the good it'd do them. Well, they struck. Most of them women, 27,000, who are dying at the average age of 26 because of the dust in the weave rooms. Can you imagine that? Well, they struck. The issues were, of course, wages, hours, and conditions, like any strike. But when the women met and talked about it amongst themselves, decided wages, hours, and conditions, that's important. But it takes more than those three things to be a woman. It takes more than those three things to lead any kind of decent human life. On the next day, the newspaper reporters noticed that there was a young woman carrying a large sign that said, "Bread, yes, but roses too." And Lawrence became the Bread and Roses Strike. What they sang was Bread and Roses. As we come marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are brightened by the beauty a sudden sun discloses. And the people hear us singing bread and roses, as we come marching, marching, we battle too for men. For they are women's children, we'll mother them again. Our lives shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts can starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. As we come marching, marching, 100 million dead, go crying through our singing their ancient cry for bread. Small art and love and beauty, their drudging spirits new. Yes, it's bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too. As we come marching, marching, we're standing proud and tall. The rising of the women is the rising of us all. No more the drudge and idler, tend the toil where one reposes, but a sharing of life's glories, bread and roses, bread and roses, bread and roses.
By now, European socialists had gotten involved. In particular, a German woman named Clara Zetkin passed a resolution for International Women's Day at the Socialist Congress in Copenhagen. But it was not until the idea reached Russia that the date of March 8 became codified. Here's ISU professor of Russian and Soviet history, James Andrews, describing those history-making strikes of women in revolutionary Russia.
The first time that women in Russia celebrated International Women's Day was 1913, 1 year before the First World War. So this is 4 years, I believe, after it was first celebrated in 1909 in the United States. And I believe that's 2 years after it was first celebrated in Europe. But it wasn't until 4 years later, during what was, under the old calendar, the February Revolution that brought the Tsar down, Nicholas II, and then the new calendar that would be March, in 1917, when it was celebrated 4 years later again. This time it was inherently tied and linked to the strikes of workers, both male and female, in the capital city, St. Petersburg, particularly textile workers.
What were their demands?
Well, during this time, the workers in February of 1917 were striking for a number of reasons. There were lockouts in factories because they were trying to bring down the working day to an 8-hour day. And women, particularly in textile factories in Petersburg, as well as in Moscow, were very, very adamant about those demands. And also, what was very important, there were a number of bread shortages in what was the end of the winter of 1917, and this brought a number of workers out to strike.
How long after these strikes did the Tsar resign?
These strikes occurred over a 3-day period. The Tsar resigned that month, abdicated the throne in February, old calendar, March of 1917. And then there's a whole other history of what happened to International Women's Day during the Soviet period under Lenin. There was a very famous Bolshevik, social democratic feminist writer by the name of Alexandra Kollontai, who was one of Lenin's associates. And she particularly urged Lenin to make International Women's Day a national Soviet holiday. And they did under Lenin before his death in 1924. However, they didn't make it a non-working holiday. They only celebrated it. It wasn't until later in the post-World War II era that that occurred.
The old calendar, if you translate that into the Gregorian calendar that we use today, that was March 8th?
Yeah, there's a 2-week displacement. So those revolutionary days that brought down the Tsar, right, are around March 8th to 11th. Later, Lenin and Kollontai used March 8th in the 1920s as the official holiday date. And we're pretty sure that the Russians borrowed International Women's Day from European movements, but in Copenhagen, they didn't celebrate it until March 18th. So although I'm not 100% positive about this, after the 1920s in Russia, March 8th became the official day. And then this was replicated in Communist China after 1949 and in other socialist countries as well, globally. When the People's Republic of China began in 1949, it was a half day off for women. Whereas in Russia in 1965, when the Brezhnev regime created a non-working day, it was an official holiday, and it is still celebrated today in that manner in the post-1991 era for both men and women as a national holiday.
But a sharing of life's glories, bread and roses, bread and roses, bread and roses.
We've been exploring the origins of International Women's Day in the strikes of women, strikes for better textile factory conditions and for bread. To pay tribute to those women and their counterparts in today's global economy, we turn to an Iowa student group that sought to impact the sweatshop labor market. Students Against Sweatshops at the University of Iowa broke onto the scene in 2000 with a series of teach-ins and public demonstrations, including a tent city on the Pentecrest lawn, lasting for several months. Here are former SAS activists Laura Crossett and Jen Shearer of Iowa City describing their objectives and achievements. Laura's is the first voice.
The Students Against Sweatshops group, both here and in many other campuses around the country, were focusing on this. You know, our university claims to have a commitment to human rights. That being the case, let's honor that by saying that anybody who produces apparel, or for that matter, any other kind of stuff with the UI logo on it, should adhere to certain conditions that we think are fair.
Yeah, and if I can just put in context, I mean, as you said, it was a multi-year campaign that started before the very public demonstrations and sit-in and went on for several years after. And in some ways, there were three prongs to the requests that students were making of our administration. One was to require that brands who license their products to use the university name, university logo, begin publicly disclosing where they're made. I mean, if you can imagine, that was the very fundamental first demand, because there was no requirement before that we even had got to find out where the things were being made. So there was first access to information. Second prong of it was that the university adopted a code of conduct, which laid out some very basic standards on what do we expect, health and safety.
You will be able to take bathroom breaks, for instance.
Right, exactly. No discrimination, those kinds of basic provisions, honoring human rights. And then the third prong was the Worker Rights Consortium. So the Worker Rights Consortium is an independent organization that monitors factory conditions, and it's particularly focused on collegiate apparel. So it was founded by student activists, essentially, who convinced enough universities around the country to all contribute a small percentage of their licensing fees toward the goal of creating a better monitoring system. So it was put in place, access to information, a code of conduct, so basic standards, and then the WRC, Worker Rights Consortium, functioning as the enforcement mechanism.
So before that, there was no code of conduct for university suppliers?
No.
There was nothing. I mean, I remember just getting the list of the licensees, and the administration was actually somewhat surprised to find out that, for instance, at the time, and perhaps still, there was a company in Indiana that made coffins that was licensed to put the Hawkeye logo on these. I mean, it was, you know, nobody had ever really thought about it, and yet there were multi-million dollar contracts at stake. In terms of the licensed apparel, Nike and Reebok had the big contracts at that time with football and basketball here, and Nike and Reebok were responsible for about a third of the salary of the coaches. Unless, for whatever reason, they didn't feel like paying, in which case the university was on the hook for it.
The part that everyone remembers was an encampment out on the Pentacrest.
Well, there were a series of various public demonstrations. There was a public encampment, but then there was also an occupation of the administration building,
that
which was really
the 6 days. You know, I tell people that's the part that everyone remembers, but there were actually several years of work leading up to that and many years of work after that. That was kind of a fulcrum in some way. Mm-hmm. We had been working for almost a year to ask the university to do these three things. At this point, those demands had been approved or backed by everyone from student government to several city council members, assorted state representatives, Tom Harkin.
Various university administration committees. Right.
Including one specifically appointed to look into this issue, had said, yes, we think these recommendations are good.
I mean, the way in which that the occupation of the administration building was a turning point was it also coincided in time with the formation of the Worker Rights Consortium itself. And our university, despite all the recommendations, still had not quite been willing to take the last step and say, we will commit, we will join, we'll be a member. And it was sort of during that period of time that they finally took that last step.
Yeah, it was so, during the sit-in that they did that. So we had done research, we had done presentations, we had gotten the backing of all of these people. University had gone to the extent of appointing a committee just to look into this, and they just hadn't budged.
Well, and I think it's a recognition of the real pressure that, you know, universities and any other institutions that are in contractual relationships with very powerful corporations are under. They were certainly hearing from them about the corporate brand's disinterest in having some kind of independent outside group being a watchdog.
Yeah.
Describe the seeds of this idea. When did you start talking about wanting to have this kind of effect on producers of apparel?
This arose in the context of a larger global justice movement. I mean, it was a very live set of debates at that time, particularly the mid to late 90s, over what the direction of the global economy was going to look like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was one of the many ideas that was coming forward at that time.
Yeah, NAFTA, for instance, was passed when I was in high school, and I remember, you know, reading about it and debating it in high school classes and thinking, mm-hmm. I don't think this is going to be such a hot idea, because I was not terribly well informed as a high school student in many ways, but I was fairly sure that, for instance, people should be able to help determine the conditions of their labor, should be paid fairly for what they were doing, and should be able to work in decent conditions. A result, perhaps, of the fact that my mother used to look for union labels on clothing when she took me shopping when I was a child. It was an issue, both sweatshops, both global labor, that I had been kind of following and thinking about and hadn't really hit on a, is anybody doing something about this? And I don't remember exactly, but I know that I saw a flyer for a very early SAS action on the Pentecost and, you know, got myself signed up on the email list. And
well, and in terms of how things started here locally, it really started with very modest educational efforts, a couple of film screenings, some awareness raising, handing out basic information about the global economy and what the university and our relationship as students was to that global economy. And again, it was part of a national movement. Part of the strength of Students Against Sweatshops was having ties and communication among student groups on various campuses who were developing their goals in coordination.
One of the fascinating things about this was I had been involved in other social justice campaigns, but this was the first time that the internet had been a part of it. And I just remember the amazement. It used to be that you'd have to, you know, have a conference call to, like, talk to other people, and they were incredibly expensive. And so suddenly, you know, you'd go over, we would go over to WEEG in the middle of the night during the sit-in and check email, and there would be these messages pouring in from all over, from, you know, students at Purdue were doing a hunger strike at this time. There were sit-ins at, I believe, the University of Oregon and a couple of other schools going on. There were about a dozen simultaneous actions that April taking place across the country. And you would be reading about them almost in real time. And it was kind of amazing. I think we take that for granted now. If you're an activist, your inbox is filled every day with sign this petition and do this thing and send this email. But this was really early on.
True. And can you clarify then, they agreed to this package of requests, and then what?
It didn't happen all at once. They agreed to join the WRC during the sit-in. That was maybe the second day of the sit-in. But we said, you know, okay, great. We would still like you to draft this code of conduct. And they kind of weren't doing anything about that. So we thought, well, we'll keep sitting in. It seemed to work for one demand. And then we were there for 6 days. We had teach-ins every day. A lot of people brought classes in, and we kept sort of trying to educate the campus about what we were doing. And at about 11:30 on a Saturday night, they suddenly became extremely concerned about our safety in the building, and thus sent in 2 shifts worth of University of Iowa police force to get us to either leave or arrest us.
Was anybody arrested?
Yes, 5 of us were arrested. I was one of them. That was an experience. But, you know, we got together actually that night and then again the next day and said, well, we still have work to do. We spent most of the next year trying to get them to draft this code of conduct.
So I think this is actually a really important question coming all the way up into the future, right? To be realistic about both the significance of the accomplishment on campuses around the country, but also about the limitations and the fact that the problems that we started out with 13 years ago are still with us.
Yes, exactly.
And so what happened once that package of code of conduct, access to information, enforcement mechanism were in place was then the hard work began, right? The hard work of how do you actually now use these potentially powerful new mechanisms to get universities to act once they find there's a problem. Having those things on paper is a wonderful thing, but it does require a kind of constant vigilance and a kind of ongoing commitment from the institution and realistically from students and community members who are going to continue to ask the institution to use those tools. So a lot of that next year going forward was students around the country engaging in the first experiments in how can we now use these tools. And so there were examples of a factory in Mexico where workers had come forward and said very clearly, our rights to organize have been violated. We've been met with violent repression in some cases when we tried to raise concerns about problems in our factory. And their connection to universities was they knew they had names or logos for several U.S. universities on some of the products they were making, right?
Yeah.
So the connection potentially to the WRC, the Worker Rights Consortium as a monitor, was there. And that was one of the first test cases.
Mm-hmm.
And the WRC, in its infancy, sent a delegation composed of university administrators and students to interview workers, a fact-finding mission, essentially, came back with that report to U.S. universities who had signed on to the WRC, and then it was up to universities to decide, okay, what do we do with this information? Now we know, you know, the sad truth about one of our licensees. And then that's where the student activism had to continue to approach administrators and say, we want you to lay down these sets of requirements for this factory if it's going to continue to be a licensee. You know, and there was a lot of strategic thinking that went into what is the demand going to be? Because there are a lot of problems with taking a stance that you should just cut contracts, because then you leave workers high and dry, and there's been a long history of factories sort of doing what was called the cut-and-run approach, which is, okay, somebody complains here, I'll close it down, put you all on the street, and move somewhere else.
Where the standards are even lower.
Right. So there was a lot of strategy put into saying to administrators, we want you to use your leverage as large institutions who do business with this company and ask that they change their behavior. There was even a domestic example within that first couple of years, right? There was a factory
in New York, I believe, the New Era Cap factory.
Cap company. Similar instance, right? Domestically, rights to organize violated, health and safety violations that have been documented. And so, same thing, testing the mechanism by having the WRC do a fact-finding mission, write up in detail the evidence that they were able to gather about what had been going on in that location for 2 or 3 years prior to that, and then same thing. And in that case, the demand was a little different. The demand was, because that's what the workers had asked us to do, the demand was, we want you to at least temporarily cut your contract with this licensee until they change their behavior. So each case is a little bit different, and there were several of those through the first couple of years. Now, I will say that this raises a problem about the sustainability of the model, because unless you always have really committed and informed administrators who understand and know how to use the tools, or you have a constantly rejuvenating student and community movement who understands and know how to use the tools, there is always a danger that they're going to sit there on paper
and do nothing
and not be activated.
It's sad that we have to do this much insane stuff. You know, none of us came here in order to hold sit-ins and get arrested and hold giant cardboard calendars outside the Pentacrest and spend our noon hours leafleting and so on and so forth. This is not why I don't think anyone really came to school. I've learned a lot.
And to go back to your example of the giant cardboard calendar, my recollection is that that particular action had to do with Nike, in particular, because we were adding a swoosh. Oh. Once the university had our code of conduct in place, the licensees were required to adopt it, right, in order to remain a licensee.
Yes.
And all of them did, except very important holdouts, Nike being chief among them. I mean, Nike was using its leverage in very, very overt ways around the country, including, you know, so for example, in Oregon, they threatened
to withdraw funding.
Millions of dollars in funding for a new stadium as a protest against having to adopt these university code of conducts. And so they were the holdouts at that time, and so we were asking the university not to give in to their pressure. Just layers upon layers.
So it was a lot of work to get what seemed at the outset to be relatively simple things, and as Jen said, I think it's a testament to just how powerful the forces that we were fighting really were.
And continue to be. And I think, so one other thing we should add coming up to the present is that as students have strategically continued to think about how does this model evolve, sort of one of the latest experiments has been developing what are called designated supplier factories. The stars had just happened to align in one particular instance in which a factory that had closed, been through a lot of turmoil, there was an investor who was interested in reopening that factory and had some awareness about the codes of conduct and was interested in pursuing, because students had already been talking about this model, a different kind of experiment. So along with Students Against Sweatshops, the Worker Rights Consortium, agreed to experimentally open a factory called Alta Gracia in the Dominican Republic that adopted the code of conduct, has agreed to respect workers' rights to organize, has agreed to, you know, being subject to independent monitoring, pays a living wage, and is producing solely for the collegiate market under the assumption or the hope that because of the awareness building that's been done within the collegiate market, there will be a market for T-shirts and sweatshirts that carry a label that says we have, under the authority that the Worker Rights Consortium and the credibility that they've built, adhered to these standards. And so far that's working. Now, even that, of course, there was a whole campaign to convince universities to place orders to that factory and then to slowly increase their orders over time so that it would be successful. And so far, we're about 2 or 3 years into that now, I think. And it has been. It has been successful. So that, I think, is a sort of hopeful model to establish different kinds of alternatives within the garment industry. You're talking about, you know, what are the forces that are going to push the industry toward possibly better behavior? And that's ultimately what you're after.
There's also, you know, an entire generation of those of us who are around at the time who know more about this, know more about how the global economy works, know more about how to run a campaign for social justice mm-hmm. and are now off doing all sorts of different things in our lives where I think we bring all those skills and all those beliefs to bear. We're all still working on this in one way or another.
I think what Laura just said is very apt for many of us who were involved in terms of the lessons that you learn about what it takes to make change institutionally, socially, globally, the kind of relationships and networks that you establish through doing that, that you can take into all kinds of other social justice work. I mean, I had already been involved as a member of my union and an officer of my union on campus here, but being involved in the Students Against Sweatshop campaign really forced and required me to learn things I would not have otherwise about the global economy. I've ended up becoming a labor educator, I think not solely because of the SAS experience, but partly.
I ended up becoming a public librarian. I actually sort of got interested in librarianship because I inherited a lot of the Students Against Sweatshop's archive. You know, when Jen was talking about how one of our earliest goals was just to get disclosure, to get the list of the places where these factories were located, that, as a librarian, is something that I push for all the time, to get basic access to information made available.
Is Students Against Sweatshop still alive and doing work?
The group existed formally as a recognized student group up through, I think, about 2006. There are still many, many chapters of Students Against Sweatshops so named on other campuses. There are other groups right now on campus, though, who have sort of taken up some of that work, including the Embassy International Chapter, University of Iowa, and a newer group that also actually goes by the name SAS, but their official title is Students Abolishing Slavery. And they, for example, are one of the groups that spearheaded the effort here to convince the bookstore to start increasing their order from the designated supplier factory. I think for all of us, the experience of being involved in making a significant change and working with other people on how to do that was one of the most important learning experiences all of us had.
It's irreplaceable. So. The feeling that you, in even the tiniest way, beat corporations with massive budgets that are negotiating multi-million dollar contracts, and that you, in your sort of scruffy cardboard sign fashion, managed to change something.
There are women of many descriptions in this queer world, as everyone knows. Some are living in beautiful mansions, wearing the finest of clothes. There are blue-blooded queens and princesses with charms, diamonds, and pearls. But the only thoroughbred lady is a rebel girl. That's a rebel girl. That's a rebel girl. To the working class, she is a precious pearl. She brings courage and pride and joy to the rebel boy. We've had girls before, but we need some more for the industrial workers of the world. 'Cause it's great to fight for freedom with a rebel girl. Well, her hand may be hardened from labor, and her dress may not be very fine, but her heart and her bosom is beating. That is true to her class and her kind. And the grafters in terror are trembling when her spite and defiance she hurls. 'Cause the only thoroughbred
You are listening to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson, and we are celebrating International Women's Day, March 8th, in solidarity with working women around the world, particularly the sweatshop workers who make our clothes. Next is my interview with ISU Vice President of Business, Warren Madden.
Thank you for agreeing to be here to discuss the issue of the licensed products that the university could have a role in regulating. Many schools, many colleges, and even some high schools around the country have chosen to use their purchasing power to have an impact on the clothing industry. Are you aware of the kind of conditions that workers around the world are subject to in clothing manufacturing?
The answer is yes. These issues are not new, and we've had conversations over the period of years about this issue. Iowa State does have a trademark and licensing program. We want to try and manage the university marks appropriately. And, you know, we need to do that within the framework of both the institutional policies and state law. Iowa State's a public institution, and so we're subject to, you know, the legal constraints the state of Iowa and the Board of Regents would apply. Having said all of that, we certainly are interested in, you know, our vendors and the people that supply goods and services to the institution being compliant with the regulations, both in the countries that they may be located in, and to the extent the United States has policies and regulations, that they're certainly compliant with those.
Does Iowa State University have a code of conduct for its vendors, a set of rules that vendors must abide by?
This statement is, the most recent one we've distributed to the licensees in this area. You know, we license the use of Iowa State University marks. In the majority of cases, the vendors that are getting the license secure their products from various sources. Many times we don't control the sources of their materials. So where they're getting their, you've been talking about clothing, where they get the clothing products, the t-shirts or the other goods from, in most cases the university isn't a direct, you know, participant in those decisions.
So here it says, at a minimum, licensees and their manufacturers and suppliers should comply with their country's laws regarding labor conditions, wages, benefits, and child labor. What if the countries have no such regulations, or what if their regulations are very minimal at best? That leaves a large opening for a lot of abusive practices to take place. Is this a concern? Many universities have a licensing code, a code of conduct that specifies the number of working hours, the protection of women from sexual assault by their bosses, protects their right to organize. In many cases, the leaders of a nascent union will be fired. Sometimes they'll be locked out. And we see in Bangladesh and Pakistan a situation where people are trapped in burning buildings and die. So do you think that, at a minimum, following the country's laws is really enough for the people of Iowa to know that that's what's going into the clothing that they're wearing proudly as cyclones?
Well, there are two levels of that question. From a personal point of view, do I believe countries and organizations should follow a set of standards and practices that may exceed those in the law? The answer to that would be yes. I think in terms of being a public institution, the university doesn't set the state's policies and legal requirements. And so these are areas where if you want to impose a broader set of standards than what Iowa law right now requires, the body that needs to make those changes is the legislative process.
I'm sorry.
We're not able to modify the legal requirements.
I'm sorry, but that isn't true. At the University of Iowa, they have a code of conduct. It's part of their license. It's part of the legal process that licensees must go through in order to obtain the right to put logos on their wear. They have to pledge not to do these following things and not to allow the factories that produce their gear to do these following things.
I don't know what the University of Iowa's requirements and standards are, and I don't know how they monitor those. My general sense is that the source of most of the materials that are used in most of the institutions are probably coming from a series of licensed vendors. There are a variety of those out there. There are certainly the large national firms or international firms in some cases that are suppliers of product, like Nike and others that are, you know, the major suppliers of product in at least some of the areas I think you're talking about. And those companies, I think, in many cases do have processes that they implement to monitor what's going on, where they're getting their materials and suppliers.
If those companies don't have a policy in place to monitor the factories where they're getting their stuff from, the workers in the factories have the opportunity to complain about conditions through local organizations, which are then linked to the Workers' Rights Consortium, which 180 universities and colleges across the country have signed on to.
At this point, Iowa State has not made a decision that it's going to subscribe to those. Those organizations have fee structures, and the resources that it takes to support them have to come from someplace. And we're a relatively small player in the collegiate licensing world. Our volumes, although $1 million is a big number at one level, that's still a very small fraction of all of this, so you have to make judgments. And okay. We made a judgment our resources are better invested in other programs at Iowa State.
So just to recap for the listeners, $1 million is the licensing fees that are paid to the university by vendors who want to sell products that bear the ISU logo or name, and the cost of belonging to an organization that would monitor factories or report abuses would be 1% of that amount, $10,000. We're talking about $10,000 and whether the university should join a network of colleges that support investigations into sweatshop abuses.
I mean, the amount you cited would be correct based on that volume and, as I understand, their fee structure. The last time we looked at all of this, which I think that letter in the middle 2005-06 period and some, you know, informal reviews since then have not concluded that we think we should change our policy. Whether those organizations are effectively using the resources they have is another judgment. As I mentioned a minute ago, it's not clear that they have their staff right now geared up to look at things like fire, you know, safety violations in these areas. The question I start out saying is, you know, under Iowa law, as we're obligated to procure goods at the lowest cost, whether you can impose standards of the, you know, on businesses that are complying with the laws in the countries they're in, I think is a question that we still have, at Iowa State anyway. By and large, the state procurement laws is we seek goods and services based on price, quality, and we're not able to discriminate against organizations solely based on, you know,
human rights.
Human rights. In the current Iowa law, that's right, solely on human rights issues.
I wonder how the Hawkeyes are doing it.
We don't do everything like the University of Iowa does at Iowa State.
I know, that's a sore spot.
Sometimes that may be good, I think.
I don't know.
Depends on the area you're talking about.
Let's talk about Alta Gracia, the clothing company that produces guaranteed living wage garments. In other words, the workers who work in this factory in the Dominican Republic are guaranteed to have a living wage, to have the right to organize. They're paid much, much better and have much better conditions than the workers of other companies.
And we made an effort to stock some of their merchandise and material. We encourage the students at Iowa State to encourage their colleagues and other students to buy and purchase this merchandise. The university bookstore, which is the store in the Memorial Union, is operated by the institution, but they respond to the marketplace, and the goods and services they sell over there are what the customers want. And we asked the bookstore to try and work with this particular vendor, and they did. They stocked some of their merchandise, but it turned out there was not a marketplace for that, and the bookstore ultimately can't be in the business of providing merchandise and nobody is willing to buy. There were also, I think, some delivery challenges with the company that the few items that they thought there was an opportunity to market more of, they weren't able to deliver the product, and then they had their own view about quantities and the amounts you need to buy. And there's no retailer that can stay in business very long that isn't driven by the marketplace. And they just were not participating in that in a way that economically was working. Customers, in the end, make their decisions about what they want to buy and where they want to buy it. And what we're doing is licensing vendors. There are a set of standards they meet. That particular statement is what we've issued to those.
That they don't break the law in the country of origin.
That's what that policy says. That's correct.
Were you disappointed that the Alta Gracia gear did not take off?
Yes.
Yeah.
I wished it had worked. I really did.
This is Greta Anderson from Local Talk. I'm on the phone with Teresa Haas, Director of Communications at the Worker Rights Consortium based in Washington, D.C. Teresa, thanks for taking time out of your day to share some information with me and the listeners of KHOI Community Radio in Central Iowa.
Thanks for having me, Greta.
So what exactly does a university get when they join the WRC? What does your organization do?
The WRC, or the Worker Rights Consortium, is an independent labor rights monitoring organization that works on behalf of our member universities in the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. to protect the rights of workers who produce university logo apparel. We currently have 180 member schools, and our job is to conduct investigations of worker rights abuses at facilities overseas that are manufacturing collegiate logo apparel and other goods, and to try to correct the labor rights abuses that we uncover at those facilities. We work closely with our member universities, with licensees, with members of the university community to achieve as much as possible for workers in those facilities.
What kind of workplace abuses has your organization helped uncover?
Well, the unfortunate reality is that the situation for workers in the global garment industry is extremely difficult. And although the WRC and many other organizations have been doing this work for more than a decade now, the reality is that conditions are just as bad, if not worse, than they were 10 or 15 years ago when we all began this work. We see a number of very serious abuses. One of the things we see most often is overtime violations where workers are forced to work lengthy hours with very little compensation. Wages throughout the garment industry are quite low, well below what is needed for workers to earn even a basic standard of living. The WRC estimates that a living wage in most garment manufacturing countries would be about 2 to 3 times the current legal minimum wage. We see very serious health and safety violations. You may have heard about the recent series of fires in Pakistan and in Bangladesh that killed nearly 400 workers. The reason for those fires is a lack of fire safety in those facilities. There were locked exits. Workers couldn't get out. There were fire extinguishers that either didn't work or workers didn't know how to use them. And a number of other health and safety problems related to the day-to-day work. We see abuses of women's rights in particular. You know, conditions that we saw 10 or 15 years ago are still there, and they're just as bad, if not worse. It's true that most major apparel companies do have some type of internal corporate social responsibility program, but those programs have been a complete and utter failure for workers in the global garment industry. We saw at the recent fire in Bangladesh, at a factory producing for Walmart and a number of other major U.S. brands, 112 workers were killed at a fire in November. And that factory had been audited multiple times by Walmart, and those audits had failed to correct the abuses that led to the death of those 112 mostly young female garment workers in Bangladesh. And that's because there is a very serious conflict of interest within those CSR programs. On the one hand, you have codes of conduct and labor standards that brands themselves have stated publicly that they intend to follow, but at the same time, they are also pressing their suppliers to offer the lowest possible price and lower prices every year. And there is a conflict that happens between compliance with labor standards and the desire to get the lowest possible price from your suppliers. And in those situations, inevitably, profit wins out. Corners are cut with respect to labor standards, and the factories that have the worst labor standards are therefore the cheapest and are the ones that get the business.
So why is your monitoring organization in a better position to address injustices in the workplace?
The Worker Rights Consortium is in a unique position because we are the only fully independent international labor rights monitoring organization in the world. We do not accept money from members of the industry. We do not have a governance role in our organization for the apparel industry, and that sets us apart from the other monitoring organizations out there that are doing this type of work. And what that means is that we are able to get substantially better, more detailed, and more credible information from workers because we don't work for their employer. We're not paid by their employer, and so they are more comfortable sharing candid details with us about what's really happening in a factory. And most other monitoring organizations, when they do their so-called audits, they do a very brief visit to the factory. They will often interview workers inside a factory in the presence of management, which is simply not an effective way to get accurate information about what's really going on.
Are fire safety concerns something that you have investigated? You mentioned that. Okay.
It's certainly something that we've looked at, and one thing that we've been working on recently with our partners in the U.S. and in Europe and with organizations on the ground in Bangladesh is an agreement that would address the very serious fire safety concerns that exist, particularly within the Bangladesh garment industry, where there have been a number of deadly fires over the past several years. And it's a program that would radically change the way that the garment industry in Bangladesh functions. It would require independent inspections of all Bangladesh garment factories with a focus on fire and building and electrical safety. And that's something that doesn't happen now. And in fact, the apparel brands that do conduct their own audits of these facilities have admitted that they don't have inspectors that are specifically trained to conduct these types of audits. And so, one thing that this program would do is it would require those types of inspections by individuals that are independent of the industry. It would require that worker representatives be given access to the factory to train workers about fire safety hazards and other occupational health and safety problems. And that's a really important piece of this because workers in Bangladesh do not have the ability to exercise their associational rights. And so it's critical that workers be given training and education and have the ability to speak out in their workplace when they do see serious fire safety concerns. The program would also require that brands assist factories financially with the necessary renovations and repairs, because we are quite certain that most of the apparel factories in Bangladesh would require substantial renovations and upgrades in order to become safe facilities. And so this is a program that thus far two major apparel companies have signed on to in the U.S., Phillips Van Heusen, which owns Tommy Hilfiger, Calvin Klein, and a number of other retail brands, and then a German retailer called Chibo.
Is this separate from the university and college apparel part of your focus?
PVH does have a part of its business that is collegiate apparel. We'd certainly love to and would welcome university apparel brands signing on to and becoming part of this agreement. But we're really looking at the Bangladesh garment industry overall.
Right.
So we're looking at who are the largest brands in Bangladesh and therefore can have the greatest positive impact for workers by signing on to this program. The fire safety program that I just mentioned would have separate sources of funding. It would not be funded by the university money. The university funding that we receive goes towards all of our factory investigative work around the world. We have staff in several different countries in Latin America, Asia, China, and they are the ones who go out and talk to workers and visit factories, who create public reports that we then can use to try to press apparel companies to make the necessary changes. And so, you know, we certainly have focused quite a bit lately on fire safety in Bangladesh, but we also have an ongoing and in-depth factory monitoring program that is funded by our universities.
A new model has arisen, the Alta Gracia line of garments that are produced in a certified factory. Can you describe that new model and its strengths and drawbacks?
Sure. So the Alta Gracia factory is located in the town of Villa Alta Gracia in the Dominican Republic. It is a factory that employs about 130 workers, and it is unique in the global garment industry because workers at the factory are paid a living wage that is more than three times the legal minimum wage in the Dominican Republic, and workers are represented by an independently elected democratic union and enjoy respect for all other labor standards under university codes of conduct. So fire health and safety standards, women's rights, wage and hour laws, etc. And it's a factory that is owned and operated by a company called Knights Apparel, which is one of the largest sellers of university apparel. And they agreed from the very beginning to a number of very rigorous standards that have created a fundamentally different environment at Alta Gracia. And it's the only factory that we're aware of in the collegiate garment industry that is paying workers a living wage. And the WRC has been involved from the beginning in monitoring that facility and verifying that it remains in compliance with these standards. And we put out regular public reports about what we find at the factory. And thus far, the facility has been in really exemplary compliance with the program standards. And we hope that it will continue to grow. It's sold at several hundred university bookstores around the country, and there's been a tremendous amount of support for the factory and for the line at universities around the country, And we hope that it can be a model for the rest of the industry to follow.
At the Iowa State University bookstore, these Alta Gracia items did not sell. Do you have any notion of why that might be? You mentioned that it's doing well. It's selling at other universities. Is it higher priced or lower quality than other brands? And where does the company make up the money it loses by paying workers more?
I think some of the reason for Alta Gracia's success at campuses around the country has been really in the educational piece of it, educating the student body and members of the university community about what sets Alta Gracia apart. And each of the clothing items does carry a hang tag that talks about what makes it different, but I think it's really critical at universities that do sell it that there be some type of education for the campus community about what makes this clothing different. The clothing is priced comparable to other clothing of similar quality. And, you know, I can't speak to all of the, you know, sort of business decisions that have been made by Knights Apparel, but they have simply chosen to accept a slightly smaller profit on the garments. And by doing so, they're able to maintain the clothing at a reasonable price and also pay workers a substantially higher wage. And it's important to note that labor costs are really a relatively small portion of the retail cost of a garment, about 1 to 2% of the retail cost of a particular item of clothing is labor costs. And so you can substantially increase labor costs without having a significant impact at the retail level.
Great. The women who organized the first International Women's Day demonstrations over 100 years ago were garment factory workers, asking for safer, more humane conditions. What would you like to say in tribute to those working women of the past? And if you could, speak to the women working in factories, garment factories around the world today.
Well, I think what we have seen, particularly with the recent fires that have happened, is that the conditions that are experienced by women workers around the world today are the same types of conditions that we saw in this country 100 years ago. We saw 100 years ago the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, in which more than 100 young American women were killed in the same types of fires that we now see Bangladesh garment workers being killed. And so, you know, I think garment workers in this country did a really excellent job of advocating for improved conditions, of tougher standards, and of better enforcement of those standards. And garment workers around the world are still advocating for those same types of things. And I think if major apparel brands here in the U.S. can be compelled to implement those types of higher standards and enforcement mechanisms that we saw here in the U.S., then that can really have a tremendous impact for women workers around the world.
Well, thank you, Teresa. Happy International Women's Day.
You too, Greta.
We've had girls before. We need some more. For the industrial workers of the world. Because it's great to fight for freedom with a rebel girl. Yeah, it's great to fight for freedom with a rebel girl.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio. Today we have been talking about the history of International Women's Day, March 8th, and the anti-sweatshop movement on campuses in Iowa. We spoke with ISU Professor of Russian and Soviet History, James Andrews, and with activists Laura Crossan and Jen Shearer, formerly of the University of Iowa Students Against Sweatshops. Jen is now the director of the University of Iowa Labor Center. We also spoke with ISU's Vice President of Business, Warren Madden, and Teresa Haas of the Workers' Rights Consortium. I received critical assistance on this show from Helen Gunderson of Ames and Karen Nichols of Iowa City. Special thanks also to Leisha Zimmerman, ISU's Trademark Licensing Program Director, for her contribution. Richard Morrison engineered the show. We heard Utah Phillips performing Bread and Roses and a rendition of the Joe Hill ballad Rebel Girl by Truck Stop Honeymoon. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org, and see listings of our past guests and resource contact information. Community Radio is your radio. please call the station at 292-2878 or write KHOI Radio at gmail.com to express your views on this show and suggestions for others. Or come down to the station at 410 Douglas and learn how to produce your own show. KHOI is staffed and run entirely by volunteers. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.